disappointed that in the three opportunities that the ICJ has had in order to call for the cessation of all hostilities has failed to do so explicitly. It's not like genocide continues in Gaza because the ICJ didn't go far enough. No, political hurdles would still be there. It allowed for weapon sanctions, like ones that were placed against Israel by Belgium, Japan, the Netherlands, and Colombia. It allowed countries to cut diplomatic ties with Israel, like Bolivia and Brazil. It allowed for the initiation of criminal cases under universal jurisdiction in other national courts. And more than anything, above all, it allows us to continue to isolate the U.S. and Israel. They can do what they're doing, but they're doing just through brute force without any legitimacy.
That's Noura Erekat. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noura Erekat on international law, real or fiction. After the 2022 Russian invasion of Ukraine, the term international rules-based order would be repeated by Washington officials almost daily to describe Moscow's action. Then a curious thing happened when Israel invaded Gaza in 2023. The term virtually disappeared as the U.S. sought to protect its close ally, Israel. The U.S. itself, over the decades, has a long record of violating the international rules-based order with its invasions, occupations, coups, assassinations, and sanctions. A compliant corporate media consistently fails to point out this brazen hypocrisy. Since the leader of the so-called free world and its allies are not held to account, the rules-based order is in total disorder. From Washington's perspective, the rules are for thee, not for me. Our guest today is Noura Erekat. She's a human rights attorney and a professor of Africana Studies in the Program of Criminal Justice at Rutgers University. She's the author of the award-winning book, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. She spoke at the Socialism 2024 conference in Chicago on August 31st. And now, Noura Erekat, International Law, Real or Fiction?
Thank you to all of you. I'm actually thrilled to see as many of you in this room as possible after what most of us teach in the classroom in the field of third world approaches to international law. So much of what we do and try to animate in the classroom has come to vivid life in the course of the past 11 months, where the world has become our textbook in understanding what is the law, what is it doing, what is it not doing, what potential does it have, can it be useful for an emancipatory struggle, is it only a site of oppression, when we use it, are we actually legitimating it to the point where it is actually causing us more harm than good? And I think all of these questions that we ask have been animated in this particular moment. The first question I want to address is international law real? Is it a thing or is it a fiction? Given the fact that it has not been able to stem one of the worst colonial genocides that we've seen in our lifetime, where we have been told that we have never seen starvation happen at this rate, where we have never seen the devastation of buildings, the amount of buildings that have been destroyed in Gaza in the past 11 months. It took in Syria 4 years to destroy an equivalent amount. We have never seen this many children slaughtered and killed as we've seen in the past 11 months than we've seen across almost all conflicts in the past 7 years. It's the rate, it's the intensity, it's the vision of it. And yet here we have all of these structures of law that have been unable to stem what is unequivocal right before our very eyes. What's happening? Surely it can't be these vapid talking points. Surely it can't be that. And so the first question I want to ask attempt to answer is the law real? The second question I want to address and answer is, so what's going on? what happened at the ICJ vis-a-vis genocide, what is the Genocide Convention, what are its limits, what is its potential, and similarly, what's happening at the International Criminal Court, what is its potential, what are its limits, is there anything to be gained from this place? And then finally ask, what about U.S. federal courts, because we know that the Center for Constitutional Rights also brought a lawsuit within federal courts in the Ninth Circuit and then at the appellate level, and now is still going up for appeal based on the urgency of the question. And then the last question I want to try to answer is, so what do we do now, if anything, with the law? I know my moniker includes that I'm a human rights attorney, but I am very, very clear and explicit that we should have no fidelity to the law. Zero. It is a form and function of power. To the extent that we ever use and leverage it, it's not to believe in it, that it has any kind of noble inherency, but instead to approach it with strategic acumen in order to leverage it for our purposes when possible. Okay, and I'll get to that. So first question, is international law real? The easy answer is no. Hard to believe that it is. And frankly, if the law were to do what we think it's supposed to do, we wouldn't be at 75 years of settler colonial elimination. Like it would have, we didn't need this moment to sow the doubt for us, for those who are particularly concerned with Palestinian liberation, to know that the law isn't doing, if it's supposed to be doing, it isn't doing what it's supposed to do. It has not stemmed the Nakba. It has not stemmed settler colonial expansion. It has not stemmed even settlement enterprise, which should be the lowest hanging fruit. It has not stemmed the acquisition of territory by force, even where it's not controversial. Why would I say it's controversial in Palestine? Because there are many legal arguments. I won't get into too many of them, but the basic legal argument that had been advanced since 1967 is that unlike the other territories that were occupied by Israel in the aftermath of the 1967 war, the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights, that the West Bank and Gaza, unlike these territories, did not have a sovereign. That the Palestinians were not a people, and therefore you could not return the land to a status quo ante because there was no sovereign that existed. This is the missing reversion or argument. And so instead, the argument has been that this is disputed territories. Even if anyone believed that was compelling, which it absolutely isn't, but even if you believe that was compelling, we just saw in what, I think it was in 2019, Israel explicitly annexed the Golan Heights, where the Syrian sovereign was never in question or in dispute, and yet we saw an explicit acquisition of territory by force and absolutely no repercussions. Again, if the law were to do what it's to do, we did not need this horrific moment in order to sow doubt for us that it's not doing what it is. All right. But the easy answer is that obviously it's not. And the reason that it doesn't work is because there's no enforcement mechanism in the international legal system, that, you know, there isn't what we have. The closest thing to an enforcement mechanism is the Chapter 7 authority of the Security Council, which is the only body that can authorize the use of force over another country or several countries. And yet what we know about the Security Council is that it is also characterized by the permanent 5 members. There are 15 members of the Security Council. 5 of them are permanent. They have a veto power. 10 of them are alternating and serve for 2 years at a time. And any one of those 5 members can undermine the will of the entire international community. And the U.S. has done that consistently, systematically, in order to protect Israel. And the only other countries where there is even something close that approximates the systematic nature of the use of this veto on the international level has been the U.S.'s use of the veto to protect apartheid Southwest Africa, currently known as Namibia, and South Africa, which we know as the Republic of South Africa. So veto powers, 5 permanent members. So if we know that the only place to have enforcement mechanism is in the Security Council, and the Security Council is characterized by this embedded flaw, then the law will never be able to do what we want it to do. It can neither regulate how states behave, nor can it punish states' transgressions. But if that were true, then we would have seen an all-out revolt against the law. And we haven't seen that because the law is doing something even for the weakest states and even in the service of emancipatory struggles, including for the Palestinian struggle. And that moment came when Palestinians actually used it quite effectively, not in this moment, I would argue, specifically in the 1970s. in the aftermath of the October 1973 war, when Egypt and Syria attack Israel, lose the battles in what's known as the October 1973 war, but win the war in demonstrating that they can actually undermine Israel's security, it recalibrated the balance of power in the Middle East and actually ushered what we know as the Middle East peace process. What Professor Abdelrazzaq Al-Takriti yesterday was talking about of the disaggregation of the Arab-Israeli struggle, which becomes instead now the Lebanese-Israeli struggle, the Syrian-Israeli struggle, the Egyptian-Israeli conflict, struggle is not the word, they use conflict, Egyptian-Israeli conflict, the Jordanian-Israeli conflict. It was disaggregating the question in order to weaken each of them as a collective and to drop Palestinians out of the bottom altogether. In that moment, in order to recalibrate their position, the Palestinian Liberation Organization wants to enter the United Nations, does so because they couldn't enter the peace process, enters the United Nations in 1974, and establishes itself in two General Assembly resolutions, which, unlike the Security Council, is not an imposing body of law. In that moment, passes two Security Council resolutions where they establish that they are the sole and legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. In doing so, they overcome their juridical erasure, which was established in the Balfour Declaration, which says that never recognizes Palestinians as a political people with the right to self-determination, but instead recognizes them as a religious and civil minority with certain rights. So they overcome this erasure by establishing that here is a people with a land, with a leadership, and the right to self-determination, and reinscribe themselves juridically. But that's a catch-22 as well, because in doing so, they're also subscribing to the very bodies of law that also recognize Israel as a political fact, that has also recognized the normalization of Nakba. Right? There's a gamble there, but they're using it politically. The other resolution that they pass, it's 3236 and 3237, is equally very strategic in that it gets around Resolution 242. The language of Security Council Resolution 242, which is passed in November 1967, some 6 months after the 1967 war, basically establishes a quid pro quo arrangement whereby all the territories that Israel has occupied will be returned to their rightful sovereigns in exchange for permanent peace. It's a promise for normalization agreements. But in that language and that agreement, it was very much considered by the PLO an instrument of defeat. But it was passed unanimously in the Security Council, including by Gamal Abdel Nasser's Egypt. But what happens is that it's worse than we think on its face, because Palestinians in that resolution are not recognized as a people, but only described as a refugee problem. And so here too, the requisite remedy will only be some humanitarian assistance to a people who don't need charity. They are asking for political power, demanding it, deserving it. What they do in 1974 in these resolutions 3236 and 327 is not just reinscribe their juridical status, but simultaneously reconstruct a definition of self-determination that overcomes the strictures of 242 and says that they can engage in negotiations, but on a path that won't recognize Israel as a political fact. If the law were only to serve the powerful, Palestinians would not have been able to achieve that. The very next year, right after this in 1974, this is the year where we're also seeing in 73 the legislation of apartheid as a crime against humanity. And the purpose for doing that is really to isolate the apartheid regime of South Africa, which is another legacy of the League of Nations mandatory system, as is Palestine. But in that situation, the mandatory power never leaves, never evacuates, and instead seeks to settle and remain as the settler sovereign. In Afrikaner identity. South Africa is not, apartheid is not merely racism on steroids. Apartheid is colonialism that is explicitly racist. It was known by the Communist Party as a peculiar kind of colonialism, even though more recently the liberal interpretation of apartheid really understands it as a peculiar kind of racism. Which is why so many people get angry that you would call Israel as an apartheid state, because they're like, no, that's not enough. We don't want equal rights. We want to decolonize. Yeah, but apartheid and ending apartheid is decolonization in the radical tradition of it. And so in 73, this idea of the move by now what is becoming a third world majority of newly liberated states and national liberation movements, they are now using their automatic majority in the General Assembly to create new law. And they create the apartheid convention to declare it a crime against humanity. In that same spirit, the next year, the General Assembly unseats South Africa from the UN. When it is led by the Algerian foreign minister, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, who has now come to preside as the president of the General Assembly, right, in the aftermath of Algeria's victorious independence movement and revolution. And the Security Council says you can't unseat South Africa. In fact, not only do they say you can't unseat South Africa, they say you're being too extreme. Don't alienate the South Africans. We have to bring them along in a peace process. Mm? And because the Security Council has the exclusive power of who is and is not a member of the United Nations, and the Security Council, as we've already covered, is rife with this flaw, what the General Assembly does under the helm of Bouteflika is to change the rules altogether to make it within the General Assembly purview of we won't decide who's a member, but we'll decide who gets to be seated. And they unseat South Africa. And the PLO, right? This is just about using the law strategically. The PLO in that spirit then says, right, let's go. We're about to unseat Israel. And then use 75 as the year that they're going to do that. And in the summer of 75, they attend multiple international conferences for this purpose. They attend the International Conference on Women in Mexico. They attend the Non-Aligned Movement Conference in Peru. They attend the Organization of the Islamic Conference in Jeddah. They attend the African Union Conference, then known as the Organization of the African Union Conference in Uganda, in Kampala, Uganda. And in each, these are all allies. And in each of these forums, the only one where they successfully get a resolution to unseat Israel was at the OIC in Jeddah. Who blocks the resolution in Kampala? And who blocks the resolution at the NAM? None other than Egypt. Because Egypt at that time is now in direct bilateral negotiations with Israel, overseen by the United States, to recoup the Sinai Peninsula through negotiations. And in that moment, they basically say Egypt, in its interest, doesn't want to alienate the United States, which they believe is the only power that can deliver the Sinai back and facilitate this. And so the compromise that comes up at each of these conferences, short of unseating Israel, is declaring Zionism as a form of racism. Everyone's in agreement. And the Organization of African Union is very explicit that their liberation is entwined with Palestinian liberation, that Zionism, like white supremacy and like other racist ideologies, is a threat to world peace. And so by the time they get to the General Assembly in 75, what the PLO does in conjunction in the third committee with this third world majority is they are about to, because they can't unseat Israel, instead what they do is they are building on what the international community is doing to isolate South Africa, which is basically launching a world conference against racism, the Decade Against Racism. In the move to launch the Decade Against Racism, it basically declares that all forms of colonialism are racism, occupation, and apartheid are illegitimate and forms of racism. And what the Palestinians do, led by Palestinian scholar, activist Fayez Sayegh, does in this moment is to amend the resolution to insert Zionism everywhere the words apartheid and colonialism appear. And this becomes a huge battle. I detail it all if you're interested, looking at the diplomatic history in a book chapter. But the outcome of it is that they passed Resolution 3379 in November 1975, declaring Zionism as a form of racism and racial discrimination. A major victory. Well, if the law only served the powerful, Palestinians couldn't have done that. And if you're wondering, well, what happened? It was the PLO that rescinded that resolution in 1991 as a precondition for entering into the Oslo Agreement. They not only rescind, I'm shocked that this is shocking. I must be very old. So they rescind that resolution. Not only do they rescind that resolution, but they also amend their PLO charter that says that they do not have a right to armed force. They basically, you know, reneged on all of their possible leveraging power in exchange for recognition and then to be put in this trap that we're in right now. One more example, if I've not compelled you enough, comes in 1977 when the PLO works with this third world majority, works with newly independent states, works with national liberation movements who are engaged in anti-colonial warfare to amend the laws of war. So as the laws of war are constructed, in the beginning as they're constructed, they're primarily constructed in a way that excludes the entirety of the global South. Warfare, civilization, humanity is limited to the global North very explicitly, to Europe and European, you know, adjacent. So when laws of war are being developed very explicitly as well, the global South is excluded from the category of civilian. They're not recognized as civilians, but they're also excluded from the category of combatant, from the category of being able to be a soldier with the right to fight. And what happens is we have the 1949 Geneva Conventions that follow the Second World War that basically legislate. Now we see a robust legislation of the laws of war that give us the four Geneva Protocols, right? The four Geneva Conventions, I should say, right? The first convention on the rights of the wounded and the sick on land, the second on the rights and the wounded of the sick at sea, the third on the prisoners of war and how we recognize prisoners of war, keeping them alive, the rights that they have. They shall not be tortured. They shall not be starved. They shall be treated well. There should be no information extracted from them until they are returned. And the fourth Geneva Convention on the rights of civilians who are occupied. But what doesn't get included and is not factored in is that the most significant warfare to take place between the Second World War through the 1960s will be national liberation warfare. And for the most part, now there's an open debate. How do we regulate this warfare where there is no formal army? This is not conventional war between two states. So how is it recognized? The United States is adamant, along with Israel, that any civilians who are taking part in war are terrorists and criminals. Adamant. And they're not alone. But certainly because of what we're seeing across the global South, this is Angola, this is Mozambique, this is South Africa, this is Cape Verde. We're seeing it, you know, of the different various peoples who are rising up for their independence. We see a global majority that basically legislates the first and second additional protocols, recognizing guerrillas as soldiers with the right to fight, which recognizes specifically and anticipates that war will be conducted in densely urban areas, that recognizes that civilians and guerrillas will not be easily distinguishable and how to distinguish them, that recognizes that civilians will bear the highest cost if there is no distinction, and so passes Article 51, that first additional protocol that stipulates that in a situation where you cannot anticipate or cannot reduce the harm to the civilians, even if it's the fault of the adversary, that that military operation shall be ceased. Those are the laws of war that are legislated in 77. So two notes on that. The first is what you think I'm going to say, which is if only the strong can pass laws, we wouldn't have had that. I hope I've made that point clear. The second point I want to make is you are being gaslit when you are told that Israel's confrontation with Palestinian militants is unprecedented. When you are being told the talking points about tunnels and human shields and the rest of it, that is actually the primary mode of warfare since the Second World War. This is not unique. It's just out of time and place. There is all the laws in order to regulate this particular form of warfare. And Israel is not alone. The U.S. tried to do the same thing when it established Guantanamo Bay and kidnapped Afghan, Pakistani, Somali, Filipino civilians and couldn't tell the difference and held them incommunicado and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where the U.S. had jurisdiction and tried to say that none of the laws of war applied, including the Third Geneva Convention, that would have given them the right as prisoners of war and the right to be treated humanely. So Israel's not unique. I also don't want to make this argument that, oh my God, nobody's ever done this. In fact, everybody's done this, and especially the government that represents us. So back to the point. That was my long point to explain that the law couldn't just be fake, which you all kind of unanimously told me that it was. Because if it was fake, then how? How did we achieve so much? And I should note that the U.S. and Israel have been outstanding objectors of the first additional protocols and have never signed on to it. So there still is that complication. But on the other hand, we know that the law is not doing what it's supposed to do. That's kind of where we started. So if there were imagine there is a spectrum, and this is in the legal literature and the kind of legal theory debate. If there is a spectrum, and on the one side you have the positivists that really argue that we should study the law as a science to understand what it means and says and just look at the text in order to give you an interpretation, and that's what it is, we would describe them in the words of Marty Koskinemi as the utopians, right? This is utopia. And we all at least can agree that's not real. And I haven't told you anything to take away from that. On the other hand, at the other side of the spectrum are the Marxists as well as the right, who insist that the law is a political fiction. And in the words of Richard Falk, who would describe it, who actually was much more of a positivist anyway, would describe it, it's basically a club with which to beat the weak. And I'm not saying that they're wrong. By observation, they are correct. But what this position leaves, really, in what Marty Koskinemi would describe as an apology for power, and it leaves out this entire potential of what people do and how they can do it using the law without being dictated by the law. This is movement lawyering, and it happens in your community, and it certainly happens on the international level. The way that I would describe it is to then say, if we are to use the law for our emancipatory purposes, we have to use it in the sophisticated service of movement. In that way, this is an analogy that I put out. Think of the law like the sail of the boat, and think of politics like the wind. If you're in a sailboat without a motor, you can only move in the way that the wind blows. And so I encourage us to pull up the sail when the winds are blowing in our direction. That's political movement. When it's blowing in our direction, pull up the sail, it's going to blow us where we want, and the law can help us. Draw the sail when the winds are blowing against us. When the balance of military, economic, social, moral authority is against us. And when you have the opportunity, make a whole new sail to pivot it in a way where we can move where we need. As our predecessors did in 74, 75, and 77, by way of example. All right. The second question I was asking, what about the current landscape and how we can understand it? Let me answer the ICC question really quick first. Let me first start by saying that the ICC, the International Criminal Court, is distinct from the International Court of Justice. The International Court of Justice is the principal organ of the United Nations. Every member of the UN is subject to the ICJ, to its advisory opinions, as well as to its contentious decisions when they submit to it. An advisory opinion is an opinion that the court is telling us what they think the law is. In a contentious suit like South Africa brought against Israel, now it's binding. In distinction, the International Criminal Court is a product of treaty. What is a treaty? It is an international contract. And as with all contracts, you don't have to abide by it. You have to agree to it by ratifying the treaty. This international treaty is the Rome Statute that's legislated in 1998, and it doesn't come into effect until 2002 when a requisite number of states sign on to it. In 2002, now we have the ICC. The ICC outstanding objectors, are you shocked? Who is not a member party of the ICC? Okay, Israel, but also? Us! The United States is not. In fact, the largest country that is a member of the ICC is Brazil. And three of the five permanent Security Council members are not part of the treaty at all. So imagine that, notwithstanding the fact that the Security Council is one of the three forms of establishing jurisdiction at the ICC. What does that mean? That means that there's three ways to get a case in front of the ICC. One of them is through, you know, the Office of the Prosecutor can decide. And one of them is that the Security Council can actually ask and transmit something to the ICC. But if that is a form of jurisdiction, and yet three, they have the authority to relay a case to the ICC, but three out of the five are not members of the ICC, you already know something's wrong. But now look at the ICC, look at the Rome Statute's actual stipulations, and I'll just give you a couple. Okay, one of them is this, what I was telling you, I think this is Article 13 on jurisdiction. But another one is also Article 17 on complementarity. And complementarity basically establishes that if a state's court system is adequate and can prosecute its own, it has the right of first jurisdiction. So that means that any country that wants to prosecute its own soldiers, say, for example, for their war crimes, that will trump the ICC authority to try that particular state. Who can make that argument and who can't? Very obvious and very clear. It's mostly going to be developing countries that can't make that argument for complementarity, and in Western industrialized countries who can make that argument, and so on and so forth. But embedded in the ICC is what Kamari Clark would describe as the enshrinement of white supremacy or European superiority, which helps to explain why, since the ICC was established 22 years ago, that only Arab and African heads of state have been brought to the court, with the exception of Slobodan Milosevic. Palestine ruptures that. Palestine now becomes the litmus test.
You're listening to Noura Erekat on International Law, Real or Fiction. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Palestine now becomes the litmus test of what the ICC will do, because now you have, since 2013, Palestinians wanting to establish, and Palestine wanting to establish its jurisdiction, wants to sign on to the treaty and does so in becomes recognized by the General Assembly as a state in 2012. Its first petition to sign on to the ICC is rejected because they're not a state. But then when they try again, now this shouldn't be controversial at all, because the General Assembly recognized that Palestine is a state and we don't need to have this. This isn't controversial anymore. It takes 6 years. 6 years, even though it shouldn't be controversial at all, between 2015 and 2021. For the ICC to finally recognize that the Palestinians can accede to the Rome Statute and be at the ICC and bring a case. That was Fatou Bensouda, the last prosecutor. She makes this decision and then still sends it to, you know, a broader panel to decide if her decision was right. She's no longer the prosecutor. Now we have Ahmed Akbar, who is the current prosecutor. At this point, we see early on, is not paying attention to the Palestinians who have put forth petitions. Try Israel for apartheid. Try Israel for war crimes. Try Israel for the settlements. Try Israel for torture. There are petitions on petitions being submitted that he's ignoring. And we see this politicization in the maldistribution of funding for how much money he allocates to the Palestine file versus how much money he's allocating to all other files. This obviously begins to change since October. But even since October, he travels to the region, does not go to Gaza. Does not go to Gaza, does not make any conclusions, but is in Israel describing that Hamas certainly committed war crimes, right? So we already know whatever we have said as scholars about the embedded, inherent inequality of these systems is manifesting before our eyes. And even most recently, when he did issue a request for arrest warrants, note two things about that request. Number one, it does not include the crime of genocide. It is almost exclusively and most strongly on the crime of starvation. But number two, there is a request for arrest warrants for two Israelis and for three Hamas leaders. So even in this moment, the law is going to do this thing of trying to do all sides, because what the law does in any context, even in your context here, I'm sure you know this, if any of you have been to court for civil disobedience or otherwise, it will drop the context out the bottom. There is no, it is a depoliticizing forum. There is no analysis of power in court or in litigation. Now it just becomes about specific rights, harms, and remedies. And in fact, it will be easier to prosecute Hamas than Israel because of the ipso facto nature of the weapons that have been used, which are not going to be subject to as much complication as Israel is going to create by saying that there's a fog of war and so on and so forth. Starvation will be different, or might be different. But all that to say, I guess what I'm trying to, you know, plant the seed for is don't hold your breath. There will be no court to save us, and certainly it won't be the ICC. Now, I say that, and yet I was part of one of the first teams that filed a petition in early November to the ICC that charged Israel with genocide, knowing full well that it was a site of unfairness, knowing full well that if they were ever going to bring a case, they would bring it against Hamas leadership. And by the way, Hamas leadership actually subjected themselves to the ICC's jurisdiction several years ago, when the Palestinians acceded to the statute. So this happens with their participation. I mean, there's no irony here. They're already being punished. Have sanctions applied to them, are already designated as terrorist organizations. As far as they're concerned, you know, they are making this play. But I'm part of, even though I'm very critical of this forum and understand what it's doing, I was part of that first petition. Why? Why? Because here we are in the first month of this onslaught of unprecedented exterminationist violence with an unprecedented use of force, where within the first week on October 13th, when Israel ordered the mass evacuation of 1 million Palestinians from the north of Gaza to the south of the Wadi Gaza line, knowing full well that that meant death. It was displacement. The ill would not be able to move. It was a death sentence. That was before we saw Israelis shooting to kill Palestinians on the quote-unquote safe routes. It's why Raz Sigal, Holocaust Genocide Studies scholar, says and publishes his article saying that this is a textbook case of genocide. So we already knew. So by early November, we bring this petition, notwithstanding this risk, not because we think we're going to win at the ICC, but because we want to make the accusation. We want to make the accusation, and we want to make the accusation on world stages, so that the lawyer who brought this case in France is giving his interviews in French. And the people who are asking in English, I get to respond to and get to lay out the genocide argument. Movement lawyering. We weren't using the ICC. I wasn't certainly using the ICC petition and the intervention in order to prove that Israel was committing genocide, you know, in this forum. We know that. Regardless of what the court does, we know that. And the court isn't even prosecuting them for that. What does the ICC have jurisdiction over? Genocide is not a war crime. Genocide is an illegitimate form of combat. It's just illegitimate. And anyway, but the point is that's how we advance the argument in order to amplify what movement is doing. What about genocide? Like the Rome Statute, the Genocide Convention within it has embedded several limitations that absolve colonial powers of violence. For the first years of trying to negotiate the Genocide Convention, cultural genocide was included squarely. That would be tantamount to the destruction of a people. That destroying their language, their access to land, their history books, that destroying their archives, that going after their sources of food and their families and so on and so forth, that everything that we feel is tantamount to genocide, that removing them from their culture and their identity would also lead to their destruction. In the final analysis, that's not recognized as part of the Genocide Convention. We know in the convention itself, with the colonial powers, this is 1948. Jim Crow is alive and well here. Colonialism is robust. This is precisely how colonial powers are extracting land and labor and goods. So they are also creating this treaty in a way that is not going to harm them. It takes the United States a long time to actually sign the treaty because of their racial destruction or their destruction of a racial group in the United States. So already it's impeded. Moving fast forward, now we see a number of Western states also try to have a monopoly about what genocide is and isn't. And we see that very explicitly also in the way that the Genocide Convention makes a distinction between ethnic cleansing and genocide, so that you can ethnically cleanse a people, but you have not destroyed them. And we see that in the Bosnia versus Serbia case, where very explicit, I would say, and Bosnians say, Bosniak Muslims assert, is a genocidal campaign that features torture camps, that features sexual assault camps, that features the mass removal of people, that features starvation, that features mass killings, but that the court ultimately recognizes as not being genocide. Why? Because the Genocide Convention also makes it incredibly hard to prove genocide through the provision of specific intent. The convention has two parts. The first is that you have to demonstrate that there was a specific intent to destroy a people based on the racial, ethnical, national, religious identity. The second part is that you have to prove that the specific acts were committed in order to achieve that intent. So it's like a double intent. How do you prove intent? Well, according to the ICJ jurisprudence, the only ways to prove intent, there's only, you know, very narrow. It's very narrow. There's a high threshold. There's a gatekeeping function that in order to prove intent, there either has to be a smoking gun, like literally a blueprint that says our purpose is to destroy these people. Or if there is no blueprint, the other way to prove intent is to derive from the acts being committed. However, it stipulates that it must be derived from those acts, that the only reason that those acts were committed were for destruction. What does that mean? That means if you starved, killed, removed for other purposes, say to ethnically cleanse, that that's not genocide and therefore there was no specific intent. We knew that too, as South Africa was preparing its petition. Why then would we support that anyway? Same movement, lawyering reasons. We want to win grounds. It's not to prove that we don't need a court to prove that they are committing genocide, but it is to win grounds. And there are two stages of evaluating genocide at the International Court of Justice. There's the preliminary stage, which is where you basically issue this petition for an injunctive relief. There's an emergency. We need this right now. And then there's the second stage that basically now is going to be on the merit stage. Where at the preliminary stage, the one that we all witnessed historically, the threshold is much lower. This intent, right, this idea of like proving this, overcoming this high threshold is not as high. It's far lower. And all we need to prove is that it's plausible. It's not a matter of fact. And then at the later stage of proceedings, which will come in some 4 to 6 years when it's probably too late, then the court decides on that other, like, higher threshold. And there, very well, the court might decide against us. But then why bring that case, knowing that full well, is precisely for the reasons that we've seen, which is to mobilize, which is to agitate, which is to have this authority in order to be able to say that the principal judicial organ of the United Nations has said this, not just us in our millions. It's a tactic. And that tactic has not been enough to stop the genocide. And again, here we get into political will and enforcement. I am as equally disappointed that in the three opportunities that the ICJ has had in order to call for the cessation of all hostilities has failed to do so explicitly. I will also say that they did call for the cessation of hostilities by Russia against Ukraine, and that hasn't resulted in an outcome either. So either way, this would have turned out. It's not like genocide continues in Gaza because the ICJ didn't go far enough. No. Political hurdles would still be there. It allowed for weapons sanctions, like ones that were placed against Israel by Belgium, Japan, the Netherlands, and Colombia. It allowed countries to cut diplomatic ties with Israel, like Bolivia and Brazil. It allowed for the initiation of criminal cases under universal jurisdiction in other national courts, like lawsuits right now against dual citizens who went to fight within the Israeli army, as in Switzerland, France, the Netherlands, and Germany.
And more than anything, above all, it allows us to continue to isolate the U.S. and Israel. They can do what they're doing, but they're doing just through brute force without any legitimacy. So the law is doing that work, even if it's not producing the outcome we desperately want to see. But that goes back to, it's not the law that's the problem. It was our expectation. The law can't do that. It doesn't do that. The law is power, and it will only serve movement to the extent that we are powerful. Which brings me to the last example that I mentioned, which was in the U.S. The Center for Constitutional Rights brought a case against Biden, Blinken, and Austin for violating the Genocide Convention and failing to prevent genocide. And here I just want to emphasize, genocide doesn't have to be complete to trigger the convention. The purpose of the convention is to prevent it, not to punish it. It punishes, but the purpose is to prevent. So there is an obligation to prevent. But suffice it to say that this case was brought on behalf of Palestinians who live in the United States, who have family in Gaza, who got to testify and tell their story, which is the greatest source, frankly, for any survivors, is to be able to tell your story to an audience, to have that ability to not be muzzled. They told their story. That story is on record in the Ninth Circuit forever. And in the outcome of that, the presiding judge actually found with the Palestinians and said that it's undeniable that this is genocide. And I cannot disagree with the ruling with this outcome. They actually make their case on the same day that the ICJ issued its ruling at the end of January. I think it was January 28th. And so he says, I cannot disagree with the outcome of the ICJ. And yet, because of U.S. constitutional law and the separation of powers that prohibits a branch of government from performing a function that's better suited for another branch of government. And here that means that the judiciary shall not impede the work of the executive branch in war making and foreign policy. That the court, even though it sided with the Palestinians, could not compel the executive branch to change course. And at the appellate level, again, it wasn't a rejection of genocide. The conclusion was that we don't have jurisdiction because of constitutional law to get around this. Obviously, there aren't arguments to be made. You can get around, but that was the outcome. And the outcome here, even in the loss, is this win, which is insufficient. So how can we use the law now? Again, at this point, we need to use the law where we can very creatively when it serves us. So where are opportunities where we can use it? I think that that's where we get really creative. One of the most important functions that the law is about to serve for us is a defensive function, as we are going to be, most of us, I imagine some of us already have been. Students certainly have been punished and prosecuted, but many of us also will be. Right now, there's two cases against the NSJP, National Students for Justice in Palestine, as well as the American Muslims for Palestine, alleging that they are in violation of material support for terrorism because of their support for Palestine and Palestinian resistance, which they're reading broadly as support for a designated terrorist organization. Absolutely shameful. The other way that I think that we can use the law also creatively is, frankly, to weaken our adversary, who has been able to basically throw shit at the wall and see if it sticks without any consequence. They can pursue all sorts of litigation against us with absolutely nothing to deter them from doing so, because there is no consequence. They can make things up about us and there's no consequence. Often they defame us, and defamation is the hardest suit to win because you actually have to prove material loss and you have to prove that it was a direct connection. And defamation lawyers, unlike other lawyers, have to be paid up front and have to be paid a lot. So you have to have deep pockets. And so there is another opportunity for us here to think creatively, for the movement lawyers in the room to also think creatively about how is it that we create a deterrence function where we make bringing a lawsuit actually incredibly embarrassing or expensive in order to protect us more. So those are some examples. The other examples I would say, and I think, and I would encourage, the ones I think I'm probably the most excited about seeing, are going to be continuing to pursue lawsuits of wrongful death and of war crimes against dual citizens who fought in this war and who come back and have total immunity and should be ashamed. And even in those cases, even if, you know, our courts and our political system is not favorable to our argument, I think that even bringing the lawsuit and making it clear and making that moral argument is going to be an opportunity as well. It's an opportunity. The law doesn't promise an outcome. It only promises a battle. And what can we do using that battle? How do we leverage that opportunity? And similarly, short of actually using these tribunals and where, you know, courts and whatnot, the other thing that I would encourage us to do is to think about, you know, people's courts. People's courts, because this genocide will end. And the next frontier of the genocide will be a narrative battle of how it's remembered and how it's described. And so it's incredibly important to write your stories. It's incredibly important to transcribe and to archive and to record the stories, your stories, the stories you've witnessed, the stories of survivors, the stories of family. It's incredibly important then to also have people's tribunals where those stories are told in a public space and at a large scale where we're also influencing how that narrative is told so that we get to narrate history, regardless of this outcome, because that is the next frontier. And that is also, however tangentially, also part of movement lawyering. But I do know that morality exceeds with whatever law does exist, even though for a lot of people, their religious law is their moral code. But those things aren't synonymous. And so what I will say, though, in this moment, our move to understand this as a moral question is incredibly important, and that is what we should be emphasizing. I will also emphasize that as we move forward, we need to think about how many peoples have endured apocalypse before us. Indigenous peoples have endured apocalypse. Enslaved African peoples have endured apocalypse. Bosniak Muslims have endured apocalypse. Tamils in Sri Lanka have endured apocalypse. Worlds have been shattered. And our world, Palestinians, our world is shattered. We are in an apocalypse. And here the question is not merely that, you know, this law, blah, blah, blah. We really are thinking about how do we recreate life after this moment? What does that look like? And there, here, this is like inherently a moral question, a question of relationship, of duty, of responsibility. The one thing I want to pull on, and the last thing I'll say is that if anything, what Zionist aggression has taught me over and over and over again is that victimhood is not a license to oppress, nor is it a license to harm. It's not up to you. And our victimhood is not a license. May it never be a license to vindicate what we see as wrong. May we always be led by a morality which makes us, in fact, superior because we have held on to our humanity. Thank you.
You were just listening to Noura Erekat on international law, real or fiction. She spoke at the Socialism 2024 conference in Chicago on August 31st. Noura Erekat is a human rights attorney, and she teaches at Rutgers University. She's the author of the award-winning book, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Ilan Pape, Thomas Suarez, Medea Benjamin, Naomi Klein, Michael Parenti, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Noura Erekat on International Law, Real or Fiction, and for her book, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine, call us 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. www.ifpr.org. PDFs and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Tim McNulty and Martin Folker. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Patti Smith, Peaceable Kingdom.
Maybe one day we'll be strong enough to build it back again. Build the peaceable kingdom back again.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh and WRCT.org. Well, we start off saying that all things are not going well right now in Washington.
Some brand new reporting in the New York Times today on a confrontation of sorts inside the White House between Elon Musk and several members of Donald Trump's new cabinet, with Donald Trump sort of reduced to the role of spectator. The Times cites five people with knowledge of the confrontation, reports this about an argument between Elon Musk and Marco Rubio. Quote, "You fired nobody," Musk told Rubio, then scornfully added that perhaps the only person he had fired was a staff member from his Department of Government Efficiency. Rubio had been privately furious with Musk for weeks, ever since his Doge team effectively shuttered an entire agency that was supposedly under Rubio's control, the United States Agency for International Development. Musk was not being truthful, Rubio said. What about the more than 1,500 State Department officials who took early retirement in buyouts? Didn't they count as layoffs, he asked sarcastically, whether Musk wanted him to rehire all those people just so he can make a show of firing them again. Then he laid out his detailed plans for reorganizing the State Department. Musk was unimpressed. He told Rubio he was, quote, good on TV, with the clear subtext being he wasn't good for much else. Where was Donald Trump in all this? The Times reports that he sat back as if he was watching a tennis match. Ultimately, he, quote, intervened to defend, wait for it, Rubio. Said he was doing a great job. Rubio has a lot to deal with, the president said. He's very busy, he's always traveling and on TV, and he has an agency to run. So everyone just needs to work together, end quote. And then for the first time since his inauguration, Trump put some restraints on Elon Musk. From this reporting, quote, from now on, he said, the secretaries would be in charge. The Musk team will only advise. Joining our coverage, host of MSNBC's Politics Nation, president of the National Action Network, the Rev. Al Sharpton, joins us. Christy and Michael are still here. Rev, I have been watching the Bannon-Musk power struggle with keen interest since it first emerged during the campaign. And I think I said on television, do not ever bet against the guy who was willing to go to jail to not testify before Congress, and the guy who sort of in I don't know if his life, I don't know enough about his life, but who seems to understand the base and the most powerful elements of the Trump base better than anybody in Trump land, and that is Steve Bannon. And I don't have any idea if Bannon has any role in all this, but it does seem like Musk has stumbled, not by taking more attention from Trump, which is how most people stumble, but by dirtying him up politically. The things that Musk is doing are not popular among Republican voters in Republican districts.
That's the whole point.